Only who could go to China?
There's an old Balkan proverb. Only Nixon could go to China.
A generation after Nixon went to Beijing, the first big sit-down between U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and his Chinese counterpart may just be a turning point for the global economy. What music will they make from this meeting? Serious opera or something else? Geithner in China, we're praying for opera on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. We kid you not, the Geithner meeting in Beijing just might be the biggest story of the week. Good morning. Coming up this hour, we will bring you the agenda on this June 1st, the Takeaway's cheat sheet on what you need to watch in the news this week, and there's plenty to watch. Also, what may be hindering breakthroughs in cancer treatments? All this and more ahead, but first, these headlines. And in the headlines, rescuers are now searching the Atlantic for an Air France jet with 228 people on board. France's transport minister says he fears the worst. Airport officials lost contact with the plane hours ago. It was flying from Brazil to Paris. Officials in Paris have a crisis center set up for family members. Attention, taxpayers, you're about to add a fallen auto giant to your swelling portfolio. General Motors is filing for bankruptcy, and the deal will give government majority ownership of the automaker. Add that to AIG. President Obama will speak in support of General Motors' move later today. The Detroit residents worry about the ripple effect of GM's troubles.
I'm scared for the city of Detroit and even the suburbs. I mean, a lot of people depend on the automotives and GM. I mean, restaurants, daycare centers, everybody. We're all connected.
All those connected people will be listening to Obama as he speaks later today. He says bankruptcy shouldn't last longer than 3 months. Speaking of auto bankruptcy, there's the whole Chrysler deal, right? The sale to Fiat clears the way for Chrysler to finish reorganizing and exit the bankruptcy process on Sunday. A judge approved the Fiat sale. Femi, what else is going on?
Hello there. The Attorney General is beefing up protection for people and places that provide abortions. U.S. Marshals will guard a number of locations, and this comes in the wake of the killing of an abortion doctor in Kansas yesterday. Police are now questioning a suspect. Pakistan's government is lifting curfews in several Swat Valley towns in Pakistan's volatile northwest region. Now, that's a sign that the military apparently feels its offensive against the Taliban there is going well. The fight has been going on for about a month. There are also reports this morning that North Korea is prepping another long-range missile test. South Korean media says that Pyongyang is moving its most high-tech missile to a launch pad. The missile is believed to be powerful enough to reach Alaska.
You're involved in this next story. Today, the Minnesota Supreme Court hears arguments in the ongoing court battle over who won the Senate race there last year. Democrat Al Franken has a 312-vote lead. What other entertainers should be in U.S. government? Do you have any ideas?
I rather see politicians as entertainers, and I was thinking of Dick Cheney. I think he would be a riot on the comedy circuit.
We are seriously asking you, what entertainers should join the U.S. government if Al Franken becomes a senator from Minnesota? Some financial news, of course, the S&P starts trading at 919. The Dow begins at 8,500. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. It's Monday morning. Let's get your week started off right, huh?
Hey, what's
our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going
yes,
on?
The stories this week to pay attention to. It's Monday, so that means only Marcus Mabry and The Agenda. He's the international business editor of The New York Times in the studio. Marcus, welcome back.
Good morning.
And Magdi Abdulhadi, Arab Affairs Analyst for our partners, the BBC, joins us from London. Magdi, thanks for coming back to the program.
Hello, good morning.
Let's begin with a story that I talked about right at the top of the hour. President Obama and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner are both on the road. Geithner is in China. Only Geithner could go to China this week. It seems to me, Marcus, that this is a huge story. You've got the biggest creditor nation meeting the biggest debtor nation. It's almost on the scale of these two nations and the kind of numbers they're talking about. Supply meets demand. What's the significance of this meeting? How do you see it?
Well, that's exactly right, John. Of course, and we're the world's largest debtor nation, and they're the creditor nation. So, in some ways, it's China who is in charge. In some ways, here, and this is at some point, this may be, reflect on international and both economic and political power. China is the one who is lending us money at this point, and Geithner's going to be interesting to see who's in charge. Will it be Geithner? Will it be his Chinese counterparts? He's an old China hand. He's got experience.
Right.
There, grew up part of his youth there. He's a guy who really has great affinity for China, great respect for China, but he has had some missteps in the past with what he said. For instance, when he said it might be something to consider when their central banker suggested that maybe there should be another international currency than the dollar. He quickly had to retract that.
Oh, and here he's trying to make a case that this is a two-way street, not a one-way street. Listen.
The effectiveness of U.S. policies will depend in part on China's and the effectiveness of yours on ours.
He's trying to make the case in sort of retooling himself from that, stop manipulating your currency, Geithner, that we saw during the confirmation hearings as a, look, you folks are way too dependent on U.S. demand, even though we're too dependent upon you buying our debt. Is he going to be able to make that argument?
Well, it's interesting. He says that, and the Chinese themselves have also said they're interested in reworking this relationship as well, because they have said, for instance, they are too dependent on Americans buying their goods as well. And they said, for instance, they're worried about American profligacy. They said they're worried about their long-term investment, which is $1 to $2 trillion of American government debt that they hold. They're worried about all the money we're spending to get ourselves out of this recession. And what will the long-term impact of all that American debt be on the value of the debt they currently hold? And the more money we print, the less valuable their money is over time. And so they, too, are interested in reworking this relationship. The question is, be how do they do this duty dance this week? I expect both sides to really be diplomatic and conciliatory this week and to really talk a lot about being partners and to really kind of bring down the kind of rhetoric that we've seen sometimes aggressively hurling across the Pacific Ocean.
I mean, one of the things, we take a drink of water there, Marcus, that one of the things we note is that human rights doesn't appear anywhere in this discussion. Not that it necessarily would with Treasury secretaries, but it's fairly important. Geithner gives a speech tonight at 10:15 in Beijing. Is there any sense that we should be watching interest rates here in the United States based on this meeting? There's been volatility last week. Is that likely to continue?
If there are mistakes, if Geithner has any missteps, if he says again, for instance, oh, well, maybe we should consider the idea there'd be another international currency, I think we can expect rates here to spike further. We've seen a 75 basis points, it's three-quarters of a percentage point rise in those rates over the last week. So right now there's huge pressure, and it comes from all the spending we're doing. And if the Chinese keep buying short-term debt and eschewing long-term debt, we can expect those rates to keep rising.
Interesting. All right. Magdi Abdul-Hadi, I want your reaction to Barack Obama leaving town, going to Cairo, Egypt, to give a speech to the Muslim world, presumably, and listen to this, it's going to reflect or expand upon these remarks delivered in his inauguration address.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
Magdi, are Muslims around the world more interested in what Barack Obama is going to have to say about the Arab-Israeli conflict in his speech in Cairo, or what's going on, say, in South Asia as Pakistan, with the U.S.'s assistance, attempts to finish off the Taliban?
I think it depends which part of the world you're in. If you're in Pakistan and Afghanistan, so you'll be more interested in what he has to say on that. But in the Arab world, where the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has played out for the past 60 years, and so that is the primary concern. And the speech is eagerly awaited. And there are, you know, every day there are various newspaper articles, columnists, editorials dealing with the issue, what will Barack Obama say when he comes to Cairo on Thursday? And broadly speaking, you can divide the reactions and the speculations into three categories. The skeptics believe it won't make a difference. The pragmatists say, let's wait and see. And the optimists see in it an opportunity the Arabs should grab. They think Obama means what he says when he says change and peace and dialogue and reaching out to the Muslim world, and he will deliver. But much will depend on how the Arabs will react and play the cards.
Well, of course, I want to, you know, the Arab, Pakistanis are not Arabs, but I'm wondering if there are more optimists regarding the Arab world and the Arab-Israeli conflict than the situation in South Asia, Magdi?
Well, the Arab-Israeli conflict, of course, has ramifications across the world and touches Muslims wherever they are in the world because of the status of Jerusalem as a holy city in Islam. And the speculation and the expectation is whether Mr. Obama will reveal a new roadmap or a vision or a plan to help the Palestinians create a state. And if the Arabs and the Muslims like what they hear, the question is then whether Mr. Obama can deliver. The skeptics, as I pointed out earlier, believe that there is a limit to what Mr. Obama can do or what kind of the level of pressure he can bring to bear upon Israel, and then he will run up against very, very strong and powerful interests. The other really equally, by no means less important issue, whether he will refer to human rights and democracy in the region, because that was...
And in Egypt.
And particularly in Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, to remind our listeners, he will be meeting a man who's been in power for 28 years, and he's turned Egypt into what many believe some kind of a police state. Others believe even it is a military dictatorship. So what will he say to Mubarak? He may not say it in public. Will he say something? Will he give a gesture of some kind towards human rights activists and democracy activists who expects him to exert some kind of pressure? And what he says on that particular crucial issue, or what he fails to say or doesn't say in public, will be the subject of debate and speculation and reactions for weeks to come.
Magdi, quickly, what do you think? Is there anything Barack Obama can do to bring Hamas into this dynamic of the Palestinians and the Israelis, or is this something that's going to have to wait?
I mean, the only thing will be to talk to Hamas. I mean, that is the...
Right.
The opinion that many people have been expressing for a while, that the only way to move this forward is to talk to Hamas. But Hamas, as you know, is classified as a terrorist organization by America and various Western governments, and that will be a sea change if this was ever to happen. It's unlikely. I
sure.
see this happening in the near future.
I would agree with you. Well, speaking of rogue nations or rogue institutions or rogue movements, here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
We will not stand idly by as North Korea builds the capability to wreak destruction on any target in the region or on us.
Marcus Mabry, a long-range missile possibly being assembled and readied for a launch sometime in the next several weeks, a continuing test of the Obama administration in foreign policy terms?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's ironic that, you know, there's the administration has talked, and the president talked last week a lot about how he's going to, this will not stand when North Korea had its last missile test. And in fact, it has stood. And of course, there's very little the administration or the UN or anyone else can do about it. And the administration has yet to grapple with that reality. This missile is another test of that. And the fact that the U.S. Doesn't really have many options that are palatable in North Korea, even fewer than they do in Iran, in fact.
So finally, Marcus, how do you feel? You're probably a majority owner, along with me and every other American taxpayer in General Motors.
Well,
feeling good today?
Those are
your Chevrolets.
It's very interesting because I think, you know, the administration has done an amazing job of really, you know, moving very quickly here. It's been an extraordinarily rapid move since they've come to power to move this company toward bankruptcy. We all own it. Hopefully we will own it not for very long. The administration, I think, is saying 6 to 18 months in bankruptcy and then out, they hope. But the question is, who's going to buy a car when millions more Americans are going to lose their jobs in the next few months?
Magdi Abdulhadi, does the rest of the world care that the U.S. car companies have gone bankrupt? Do we take a hit? Are we on the ropes in the international world?
Well, I mean, you know, of course the rest of the world cares because what happens in American economy affects the rest of the world.
At least we got a headline in the rest of the world. GM has officially filed for bankruptcy. Thanks to Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times, and Magdi Abdulhadi, Arab affairs analyst for our partners, the BBC, talking about the Obama speech in Cairo later this week. That's your agenda, folks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Well, we report on the Minnesota Senate race and how it's been going since Election Day. We report, but it's the Minnesota Supreme Court that's going to decide if Al Franken may actually become the state's junior senator. We were asking you, as a result of all that, what entertainer do you actually see in office besides Al Franken?
I think Michael Moore and Jello Biafra should definitely get into office as president and vice president, maybe in 8 years.
Great, so we can look forward to Michael Moore on Bill O'Reilly again, right?
All right, here are the rules. Ready? I ask you a question, then you get to ask me one, and then back and forth. You all right with that?
That's fair. We'll just stick to the issues.
The issues.
All right, good.
Tell us your stories. Entertainers in office, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Hey, Ronald Reagan was an actor. Oral arguments start today in Minnesota Supreme Court to finally figure out this Coleman versus Franken thing. Tom Scheck, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, has been with us from the beginning of this story. He joins us from St. Paul in a few hours, days, or weeks. Tom, we're not going to be able to play this tape anymore, right?
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Do enough people like Al Franken to make him the senator? And I guess some of those people would have to be judges, right, Tom?
It's only five that matter right now, and that's the five judges. The other 58% that didn't vote for him, it doesn't really matter since this election has been this close. And you may actually hear Al Franken saying that on the Senate floor. Who knows?
Who knows? Although he's been very stern about his previous career as a comedy something or other. It seems like he wants to forget that
satirist.
It ever happened.
Satirist. He called himself a satirist, not a comedian throughout
that's
the
right. That's right. Oh, that's so funny. All right, well, describe what the procedure is here exactly and what's at stake.
Well, these five judges, there's seven total, but five who are going to be hearing this case are going to take oral arguments today for an hour, and they're going to listen to the arguments from Norm Coleman, who appealed a three-judge panel's ruling of the recount. And he's saying that the three-judge panel, which there was a recount that occurred, Norm Coleman didn't appreciate the way the recount was handled because he said there should have been more absentee ballots included. So he appealed it in the courts. And in Minnesota, they have this interesting legal framework where the appeal automatically goes to a three-judge panel. That took months. The three-judge panel ruled that Al Franken got more votes than Norm Coleman. And then what Norm Coleman did was appeal to the Supreme Court, which is the next step. And so here we are. Norm Coleman is saying that the three-judge panel and the recount committee did not count enough votes. They did not count absentee ballots that they thought should have been included that were rejected. So the five-judge panel of the Supreme Court today is going to hear these oral arguments. Both campaigns have submitted written briefs, but for an hour today, Norm Coleman's legal team and Al Franken's legal team are both going to speak before the judges. It's going to be a lively interaction. This has happened in the past in this race where they've appeared before the Supreme Court, and the judges pretty much pepper these lawyers with questions going back and forth, and then they go from there.
And I understand Norm Coleman is actually a part of his legal team, although I don't know if he's going to actually be in court doing the peppering there. But let's talk a little bit about...
going to be in court.
He's going to be in court, right.
He has not spoken to a judge at all. He just sits there.
Now, is the legal issue here a finding of fact by the Supreme Court, or are they basically just ruling on whether the three-judge panel was right in its decision?
Well, the Supreme Court could do two things. They could say, we agree with the lower court, Franken won, and then they're going to go from there. And what could conceivably happen is the election certificate could be issued, or they could say, you know what, Norm Coleman's right on this one avenue. We're going to order the three-judge panel to go back, request these ballots, and count these ballots. So there could be more counting that occurs. But that doesn't mean that Norm Coleman is going to be the winner, because Norm wants about 3,000 more absentee ballots included. And with the Franken's lead at about 325, 326 votes, it doesn't matter. It may not matter. Franken could keep that lead.
He could lose. Yeah, that's right. He could still lose. Anyway, finally, can the governor sort of intercede here and say, courts, get out of this. I'm going to decide?
He can't do that. But what he could do is after this, when this Minnesota Supreme Court determines the verdict here, what he could do is say, I'm not going to issue this election certificate. And he hasn't come out and said, I'm going to issue it. He hasn't said whether he's going to sign it or not. And that's kind of the big play right now in terms of what Governor Pawlenty is going to do. He is a Republican. He does support Norm Coleman. He hasn't wavered from that. And he's been very careful to say, I'm going to determine what the courts tell me to do. But he's almost even giving himself this leeway here where he may say, well, you know what? And he has hinted this way that he agrees with Norm that some of these votes should have been counted and they weren't. So he could hold off and not sign it. Now, the Supreme Court, on the other hand, could say in their legal opinion, when it comes out, is we believe Al Franken is the winner. And we also believe that the election certificate should be issued. If that's the case, then Governor Pawlenty is going to have to probably sign that.
Right. So you've described a scenario where if Pawlenty were to do something that gave it to Coleman, he would be tainted in a sense that there's a political relationship between Pawlenty and Coleman. He would be tainted when he stands for re-election. Is there any scenario under which Franken is tainted for some sort of political reason, depending on how this turns out, the political affiliation of the judges, et cetera?
No, I don't think that that's the case. And just to clear up, Pawlenty couldn't give the election certificate
right to
Norm Coleman. What he could do is say, I'm not going to give it to Al Franken until Norm Coleman appeals this on a federal level, which he's hinted that he could do. I don't know if that's really the case. There has been a lot of concern that the ballots that have been counted, you know, went to Franken, that there's been some ill will in terms of county election officials, and there have been missing ballots in Minneapolis. That's kind of the thing that could taint Al Franken.
I guess the operative phrase there is could. Tom Scheck, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, thanks for your wall-to-wall coverage on this story. The drama of Al Franken and Norm Coleman, who will be the senator in Minnesota, we'll find out. Thanks so much, Tom. Femi OK has the headlines now.
At 28 minutes past the hour. Four civilians are dead in Baghdad today after a bomb exploded in a market. More than a dozen others were wounded, and militants have frequently targeted the popular market. It was the site of a car bombing last month that killed 15 people. May was the deadliest month for American troops in Iraq since last September. A new count says that 24 service members died last month. This brings the total number of U.S. casualties since the 2003 invasion to 4,300 people. More details are coming in about the missing Air France jetliner this morning. Air France says the plane bound for Paris from Rio de Janeiro had reported an electrical short circuit. It also indicated that it had flown through a stormy area with some strong turbulence. The plane was carrying 228 passengers, and Brazil's Air Force is now searching off its coastline for signs of the missing plane. And finally, in sports, the NBA finals are now set. The LA Lakers will take on the Orlando Magic. Playoff action over the weekend settled things, and the Magic beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Lakers beat the Denver Nuggets. Game one of the finals, Thursday night. John.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. John Huckenberry here. Some consumer economic information just out. The Associated Press reports consumer spending dipped a smaller than expected 0.1% in April, while incomes grew by 0.5%. Possible presages of how Wall Street's going to do when it opens in an hour. You may have missed it, but the world's largest annual cancer research conference convened over the weekend in Orlando, Florida. The American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting was dominated by discussions of cutting-edge science and healthcare policy. Joining me is Ken Lichtenfeld. He's the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for the American Cancer Society, and he's in Orlando where the conference was held. Len, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, the scientific headline, there's been talk of something called a cancer vaccine, but it's more of a genetic therapy for cancer. Am I right? And explain the details, if you could.
Well, John, it's interesting. It is, in fact, a vaccine in the sense that we've been looking for years, decades, in fact, for almost, I would say, at least 40 years, as long as I've been involved in cancer treatment and cancer research. We've been looking for something that where we can take the body's own natural defense mechanisms, our immune system, rev it up, and use that to fight cancer. And we've had so many false starts and false hopes. But this year at this meeting, we actually have some papers that have been presented that suggest that maybe we're finally starting to sort of turn to success, shall we say. And there have been a couple of papers reported that they've certainly looked promising in the sense that we may have figured out how to get a vaccine that may help us effectively treat cancer.
Now, why is it that even in these papers that were presented, the longevity of this vaccine is limited? Is it that the cancer changes to trick the immune system, or the effect of the immune system activation in some of these therapies doesn't last very long?
Well, probably a combination of the two. You know, it's been very complicated. You know, we've known for years that cancer cells have differences on their surfaces that, you know, just like a bacteria or a virus or whatever, you know, our bodies fight these things because there are differences in the cells and the bacteria and the virus cells that set off triggers that help our bodies recognize the invader, so to speak, and develop antibodies. Cancer has those same things. But cancer is a very wily disease. I mean, it's not just one change here or one change there. And it's not always consistent. In some cancers, there are consistent changes, but not in every cancer. And being able to harness that, to be able to identify that change and make an effective vaccine that works on that person's cancer has been tough. You know, there's another paper yesterday, not about vaccines, but it was a presentation talking about the genetics of cancer. And we finally have gotten to the point where we really understand what makes a cancer cell, but we've also learned that each individual cancer, that is a colon cancer one person, a colon cancer another person, they're different. They're not necessarily the same. So being able to take those cells from that patient, process them, return them, make them effective in terms of developing this immune response has really been quite a challenge.
So the strategy of using a person's own body as the defense mechanism really becomes even more important with that kind of research. I'm wondering how the American Society of Clinical Oncology and all the people at the world's largest annual cancer conference are feeling about their field as the Obama administration prepares for a major sort of restructuring, at least that's what they're talking about, of the healthcare system.
I would venture to say that they're a little bit concerned. You know, we've learned a lot about cancer treatment over the past 30 years. There's no question about that. But by the same token, a lot of the treatments we offer are what we call off-label. That means they're effective. They've been shown in scientific research to work, but they've not been approved by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, for that particular use. And it's becoming more and more clear going forward in healthcare reform that we may have higher standards of evidence, shall we say, in order to use certain treatments in certain diseases, not just in cancer, but in diseases in general. And I venture to say that there's a little bit of concern that with healthcare reform and the concerns about costs, that there might be, shall we say, an increased focus on what we do, how we do it, the treatments we use. Now, I have to say that in part that's not all bad. We spend a tremendous amount of money on health care in this country. We do a lot of things in this country that don't necessarily help patients. But there is a concern that in this effort to try to become more focused, more evidence-based, that we may actually go a little bit too far and perhaps take some of the treatments we now know to be effective and may put some restrictions on those treatments and may put some restrictions on those various diagnostic tests and some of that
sure.
technology.
Well, Len, what do you say to the argument that the off-label world, the off-label domain, is an opportunity for pharmaceutical companies to go around the regulation and that that's really hard for consumers to keep track of, let alone creating troubling questions about what's the regulation even for?
Well, you're absolutely correct. We've run into some trouble. Most recently, I think the best example are drugs we called ESAs or erythropoietin, and those are drugs that were used to boost the red cell count. And a tremendous number of the uses of those drugs, or times they were used, shall we say, were in off-label situations. And it turns out, after, good golly, since 1990, when we started using those drugs, it turns out that, in fact, we may have been harming a substantial number of patients in the off-label use. Eventually, we have to come to a balance. We know that certain drugs are used effectively off-label. We have to develop a structure that's reasonable, appropriate, somewhat middle of the ground. We're never going to be perfect. We can't be too strict. We can't be too liberal. We have to figure out a way how to harness our knowledge, harness consensus, harness scientific expert consensus in order to make sure we use the drugs as appropriately as possible while not causing harm.
Well, finding that balance will certainly be a part of the debate in health care reform. That's Chief Medical Officer for the American Cancer Society, Len Lichtenfeld, as oncologists from around the world gather in Orlando, Florida, to think about health care in the United States and how it's going to affect cancer research. Thanks so much to Len. And as Al Franken and Norm Coleman face off today in Minnesota's Supreme Court, Franken finally might become the state's junior senator, another entertainer in office. What other entertainers do you see taking office in the U.S. government?
I think Whoopi Goldberg would be a good senator. She's outspoken and open-minded.
What's your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org? Femi Oke has the headlines now.
Thank you, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Air France says that its Airbus jet that disappeared over the Atlantic hours ago had reported electrical problems before it lost contact. The plane has also experienced turbulent air. The flight left Rio de Janeiro yesterday and it was heading for Paris. Now, it should have landed several hours ago. The plane was carrying 228 passengers and Brazilian officials are now searching off their country's coastline. General Motors has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection today. It's part of the Obama administration's plan to shrink the automaker and give the government a majority stake. The president is expected to announce an additional $30 billion in aid to GM later today. Automaker Chrysler is hoping to emerge from bankruptcy this week. It recently won approval from a bankruptcy judge to sell its assets to a group of buyers, including Italy's Fiat. And finally, in sports, in NHL action, the Pittsburgh Penguins will return home tomorrow for Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Series. The defending champs, the Detroit Red Wings, handed Pittsburgh their second loss of the series yesterday, outshooting them 3-1 in Detroit. And that's your news.
Red Wings. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and probably no one in the world would disagree with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who spoke to students at Beijing University yesterday about his upcoming meeting with Chinese officials in Beijing.
How successful we are in Washington and in Beijing will be critically important to the economic fortunes of the rest of the world.
All the eyes and all the wallets of the world will be watching as Timothy Geithner sits down with President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao to talk about the Chinese and U.S. relationship and its impact on the global economy. Quentin Somerville, all eyes will be watching, including the BBC's, right?
That's right, yeah. We'll be expecting some reassurances there. We got some today from Timothy Geithner. He said to his Chinese hosts that your money's safe, basically. All of those many billions of dollars that you've invested in U.S. Treasury, well, he said Chinese financial assets are very safe. That actually got a laugh from the audience at Peking University, but he'll be hoping that Hu Jintao and Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, when he meets them tomorrow, that they'll take him a bit more seriously.
Well, Quentin, it's really interesting because this meeting has a very important domestic message that must be delivered to the Chinese people. And of course, they're the biggest savers in the world. Their investments are in U.S. treasuries in banks all over China, including the Chinese government's. If their investments aren't safe, they stop borrowing. Interest rates spike in the United States, mortgage rates spike, demand goes down, and we're back plummeting in the global recession once again. Is that about how it works?
It's all one big ball of wax. And as he said towards the end of his speech, he said, look, global problems will not be solved without the US and China working together. That's why he didn't give China too much of a hard time about currency manipulation, that allegation that we've heard time and time again, that China's keeping its currency low, that that means exports from China cost less, and that that's costing US jobs. This is very much about being nice to the Chinese and saying, look, guys, we've got to work together if we're going to get out of this mess. Because remember, the Chinese economy is still powering along just fine.
Yeah, I mean, they have growth of close to 10%, maybe a little bit under 10%, most nations in the world would envy that sort of thing. Let's talk a little bit about, are there any U.S. demands, for instance, that the Chinese economy try to become less dependent on purchases by U.S. consumers of Chinese exports?
Exactly. Timothy Geithner said, look, when all this is over, when the dust settles, we've got to change the rules of the global economy. The world cannot be dependent on the US consumers spending like crazy. And in particular, China can't be dependent on that. All those Chinese factories, millions of workers have lost their jobs because US consumers have stopped spending. Actually, he's preaching to the converted here because the Chinese government realizes this already. But it's a long process to take an economy which is dependent on cheap exports and building domestic demand. And here, Americans spend a good deal more than your average Chinese consumer. That's a shift that China's trying to make. It's been doing that. That's why its economy is still growing, but it's still got some way to go.
Finally, Quentin, Wall Street trading futures are up this morning, suggesting that Wall Street's going to open positively in about 45 minutes. But there's some talk that the Chinese, in their purchases of U.S. debt, are favoring short-term debt over long-term debt, and that could bear on volatility of interest rates. Do you have any guidance on that? Certainly all the financial people are watching to see the tea leaves there.
I'm not going to be able to call that, but what I can tell you is it's in China's interest that the U.S. economy recovers as quickly as possible.
All right, Quentin Somerville, BBC reporter in Beijing, watching the Geithner meeting with Chinese officials, including President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao. Of course, Timothy Geithner is the U.S. Treasury Secretary. Thank you, Quentin.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's Al Franken v. Norm Coleman in front of Minnesota's Supreme Court today. The court may determine that Al Franken may become the state's junior senator, which motivates us to ask, is this the Al Franken latest entertainer to enter the U.S. government? What entertainer do you see in office? Persephone writes to us, Martin Sheen for president, of course, and Allison Janney for vice president.
Thanks a lot. I wish I could spend more than a few minutes with you, but the polls don't close in the East for another hour, and there are plenty of election results still left to falsify.
Cancel Barack Obama and replace it with the West Wing? I don't think so. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Keep the suggestions coming. Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. So we're getting some more details in about the missing Air France jetliner. Families are waiting for the plane to arrive in Paris were greeted by this announcement this morning.
Your attention, please. We can fly passengers waiting for the Air France flight.
So that's the Air France flight F447 coming in from Rio. So all signs point
They're telling
to
them to go to the information desk?
They
oh, that
are.
Is spooky.
And that's the last thing you want to hear when you're basically waiting for families or friend at an airport. So all signs point to a major disaster for that passenger plane. It was flying from Rio across towards Paris. Now, air traffic officials have lost contact with the jet and 228 people were on board. The airliner says that it got a signal of electrical problems as the plane went through some heavy turbulence. It's not clear what happened next, but France's transport minister says that he is fearing the worst. Minnesota's Senate race starts a new chapter today. Last year's Senate race is still undecided. Today, the state Supreme Court will hear arguments in the ongoing court battle over who won. Democrat Al Franken has 312 votes, and he has a lead over Republican Norm Coleman. That's his lead, by the way, not his total number of votes. Coleman wants the court to count a batch of rejected absentee ballots, and the rival camps has spent a combined $50 million going after the seat. And in Pakistan, Pakistan's government is lifting curfews in several Swat Valley towns in its volatile northwest area. Now, apparently, the military is feeling confident in its offensive against the Taliban there. And that is a look at some of the top stories making headlines, John.
Thank you, Femi. So here's a story you may have missed. He was known as a pioneer of ethnic studies in this country. Ronald Takaki, author and scholar, died last week at the age of 70. In the wake of his death, his Facebook fan page with over 1,400 fans was turned into a memorial page for people to leave messages. One typical message: you've exemplified multicultural education in your writing, your work with students, and your way of being in the world. Professor Takaki died of an apparent suicide after a 20-year struggle with multiple sclerosis. Takaki's struggle was mostly, though, with academic departments and helping them to create ethnic studies departments and create departments that became the models for ethnic studies throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. And joining us today is Gary Okihiro, who is professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University, founder of the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at that university. He studied under Professor Takaki at UCLA. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
How important is this man in taking a broad social movement and turning it into an academic field of study that has changed curriculums and academic departments all over the United States?
An extremely important role, as you've indicated. I mean, previously, most scholars looked at relations among people, mainly between blacks and whites within the United States. Ron took blacks and whites because he began as a historian of African-American history, but he also included the voices of Asian-Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans, along with some European ethnic groups. And so the look across those diverse groups afforded a different perspective on the American experience.
And, you know, the irony here is that often the departments that he helped to create were criticized as being somehow anti-American or embracing an anti-American story. But he always insisted that, no, in fact, ethnic studies was about rediscovering the real American narrative of ethnic assimilation or ethnic sort of development in the United States.
That's correct, and I think a lot of that derives from his childhood growing up in Hawaii, as he indicated in several of his books. He believed that the American story, like the story in Hawaii, was a multicultural one, and that each group contributed greatly to the makeup of overall America. And the exclusion of any one group thus would leave a huge gap within that narrative. And his inclusion of voices, particularly the oral traditions of people, along with poetry and so forth, was a riveting way to relate those stories.
Do you think, Professor, he was frustrated that the story, and it's a very compelling story, of the natives on the Hawaiian Islands did not get the kind of national play, the sort of heroic sort of familiarity as, say, you know, the George Washington cherry tree fables?
That's a perceptive observation, not only within the broader American narrative, but also within Asian American studies itself. Hawaii has been seen as an exceptional place, a racial paradise, as it were, and also distant from the continent. I recall just this summer hearing Michelle Obama describe her husband as being born way out west, and the reference of Hawaii thus as a kind of distant place resides still in the American imagination.
Interesting. Listen to Ronald Takaki speaking on November 17th of 2008, and I want your reaction. He's definitely pushing way beyond his original agenda. The time has come, he says.
Don't you think that the time has come for the University of Texas to consider establishing a multicultural requirement for graduation? Yes. Don't you think so? The time has come.
Here you have Takaki suggesting that with the election of Barack Obama, it is time for America to create a requirement of multicultural fluency. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I favor that also. The core or the requirements of all graduates indicates a university's commitment to its idea of education. That is, what is an educated person supposed to know about this world around them? And clearly, the world around our new graduates is this diverse America, but also a transnational and global society. And our students thus must be literate within these various traditions to operate successfully within this realm.
Professor Okiro, what do you think Ronald Takaki would make of the discussion in the wake of Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the Supreme Court, a discussion of her story and what it means politically?
Well, actually, it would resonate very clearly with what he encountered in his own discussion about multiculturalism, because as I earlier indicated, his use of voices was a means by which to offer a diverse perspective. That is, individuals offer a particular kind of perspective on the story that one might not understand coming from the outside of that perspective. And I think that's what the nominee's point was, that her experience as a Latina provided her insights into the American experience quite different from the typical white male person.
You know, his 20-year struggle with multiple sclerosis reminds me that the model for disability studies in many academic departments around the United States, and particularly in California, really comes from his ethnic studies models. And in an odd way, he even has a legacy there.
I believe so. And his real struggle with it has taken, of course, this tragic turn.
Gary Okahiro, professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University, founder of the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race, who also studied under Ronald Takaki at UCLA, who created so many ethnic studies departments around the United States. Thanks for being with us. And we're going to leave you all with the words of Professor Takaki speaking in 2009.
For me, Obama's victory sent a scintillating message across this country. The time has come for us to have a more inclusive and hence more accurate history of America as a nation peopled by the world. And so I welcome this because I'm thinking we can rethink the way we think about American history so that names like Obama and Takaki are no longer funny names.
Professor Ronald Takaki speaking just before his death last January. He died last week at age 70. So Al Franken and Norm Coleman face off in Minnesota's Supreme Court. It's a big news story. Franken might finally become the state's junior senator. So what other entertainers do you see in office? We've got Fred Thompson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jesse Ventura. Who's next? Jerry Springer, maybe?
Hey, welcome to the show today. We are talking to people who have had their lovers stolen by a skanky slut.
Yeah. Hey, he was the mayor of Cincinnati. I kid you not. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe at iTunes or thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
The more money we print, the less valuable their money is over time. So they, too, are interested in reworking this relationship. The question is going to be, how do they do this duty dance this week? I expect both sides to really be diplomatic and conciliatory this week and to really talk a lot about being partners.
Marcus Mabry of the New York Times talking about Geithner in China. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Opera stinks. We know that.
It smelled sort of like a burnt tire or burning hair, but they had a little bit of that lime base that they had with all the greens in it.
Whatever you think of opera, it is a multi-sensory art form. This morning, a look at a historic concert with a real sense of smell. Orchestra and smells together again on the same stage. It's not over until the fat tenor stinks, right?
So you could tell it was a green color, but it was still filthy.
does not smell like teen spirit on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, the Nirvana of Turandot. But we really are going to be talking about an opera for your nose later on in the hour. It's Monday, June 1st. I'm John Hockenberry. Also, we'll visit one of our Detroit friends to see how the latest auto industry bankruptcy news is playing out there. A long, strange trip it's been. Also, everything you need to know about the coming big sports matchups. All this and more ahead. But first, these headlines. And in the headlines, a major disaster, it appears, for a passenger plane over the Atlantic. Air traffic officials have lost contact with an Air France jet flying from Brazil to Paris, 228 people on board. The airline says it got a signal of electrical problems as the plane passed through heavy turbulence. There's a crisis center operating in Paris for families of the passenger and crew. Economic news just out this morning. Consumer spending went down a bit in April, but not as bad as predicted. Personal income went up in the same period. Both beat expectations. Bankruptcy time for General Motors. The automaker filed this morning. President Obama will speak in support of GM's move a little later today. The new deal will give the government official majority ownership of the automaker. Meanwhile, Chrysler, according to a judge, a bankruptcy judge, can be purchased by Fiat to clear its way to possibly get out of bankruptcy. Femi, what else we got going on here?
Hello there. The Attorney General is beefing up protection for people and places that provide abortions. U.S. Marshals will guard a number of unnamed locations. This comes in the wake of the killing of an abortion doctor in Kansas yesterday. Police are now questioning a suspect. Pakistan's government is lifting curfews in several Swat Valley towns in Pakistan's northwest. That's a sign that the military apparently feels its offensive against the Taliban there is going well. There are reports this morning that North Korea is prepping another long-range missile test. South Korean media says that Pyongyang is moving its most high-tech missile to a launch pad. The missile is believed to be powerful enough to reach Alaska, and the test could come as early as a week from now.
The opera in the Minnesota Supreme Court could be over today. The court hears arguments in the ongoing battle over who won the Senate race last year in Minnesota. Democrat Al Franken has a 312-vote lead over Republican Norm Coleman in the current count. We'll take a deep dive into that story in just a moment. Today's the first day of hurricane season. Oil prices are surging this morning, $68 a barrel. It's close to that anyway, nearly double the March price. Asian markets closed up this morning, and the S&P starts trading at 919. The Dow begins at 8,500 without GM because it's in bankruptcy. What entertainer do you want to see in U.S. government, Femi?
Sean Connery, CIA.
Sean Connery, CIA. Al Franken could be a senator. What other entertainers do we need in the U.S. government? Call us at 877-8-9. My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. A lot of news we're following this morning. A plane disappearing over the Atlantic Ocean. More about that later on in the program. Also, a big story out of Wichita, Kansas, where an abortion doctor was shot to death yesterday in the foyer of his church as he handed out bulletins. George Tiller was one of a few doctors in the United States who performs abortions late in pregnancy, and police yesterday took into custody a 51-year-old Kansas man who is expected to be charged with murder today. George Tiller should be no stranger to a lot of people who are concerned with the abortion issue around the United States and, say, would have observed the Bill O'Reilly show on the Fox News channel, who referred to Tiller as many as 28 times. Here's one reference.
Tiller himself donated money to her campaign. She doesn't seem to be real upset about this guy operating a death mill, which is exactly what it is in her state, does she?
That's Bill O'Reilly talking about George Tiller allegedly contributing to Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius's campaign. The question really is, was there an environment and an atmosphere of threat surrounding this doctor, and what could explain the fact that he was shot in his church? Not the first time he was shot. Joining us now is Monica Davey, New York Times reporter in Chicago, who has a story about the shooting in today's paper. She's in Chicago. Monica, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
And here in the studio is Eleanor Bader, co-author of the book Targets of Hatred, Anti-Abortion Terrorism. She writes about reproductive health for the OnTheIssues.com website and RHRealityCheck.org. Eleanor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Monica, where do we set this into context? Is this an individual act of terrorism, or is it somehow affiliated with a broad set of beliefs that Dr. Tiller was at odds with?
Well, Dr. Tiller certainly was somebody who drew lots of attention and controversy over the years, and there are reports this morning that the person who is a suspect in the case has not yet been charged, was in some ways a member of anti-abortion groups, was someone who had been a member of anti-government groups, and someone who at least was in agreement with that philosophy.
Now, are police saying anything about his specific affiliations, and was there any sort of security detail that either Dr. Tiller had asked for or that law enforcement authorities had suggested in this particular case?
Police are still looking at what affiliations this man had. In terms of security, again, over time, Dr. Tiller had many different types of security measures, mainly because he had been attacked before. You know, he had been shot in both arms at one point and had had his clinic firebombed. So he certainly was, this was nothing new to him in a way. As I understand it, there was not even a security camera inside the church.
Eleanor Bader, what do you think this says about the atmosphere for this kind of violence here a few months after the inauguration of Barack Obama?
Well, first, I think that the point I want to make is that in a survey that was done in 2008 by the Feminist Majority, they found that 20% of clinics report that they had themselves experienced severe violence, blockades, stalking, invasions, all kinds of really heinous anti-abortion activity. But once Obama won the election, the anti-abortionists really ramped up their rhetoric. And there's been an increased presence outside clinics throughout the country. Even clinics that had previously seen one or two protesters on Saturday were suddenly seeing 15 or 20 or 50 screaming their guts out and jumping into cars.
Eleanor, how important is it for us to distinguish between free speech domain kinds of protests, harassment of individuals who are using clinics, and the kinds of brutal violence that's characterized by this shooting over the weekend?
Look, I think the pro-choice movement has always been really clear that the anti-abortionists certainly have the right to express their opinions. When they stand outside clinic doors, they blockade entrances. They jump in Pittsburgh. They were jumping into patients' cars to try to scream at the woman in the car, "Don't kill your baby. You're a murderer." I was just a few weeks ago in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is one of the hot spots in the U.S., and the anti-abortionists there were literally screaming at one guy who was wearing a yarmulke, you know, "You're as bad as the Nazis. You're a Nazi."
But isn't it wrong to characterize even that aggressive behavior as in league with this individual who killed Dr. Tiller?
The rhetoric ramps up those people who are inclined to violence. When they hear over and over and over again that you're a murderer, you're a killer, you're a Nazi, you're a baby killer, you're a horrible person who is a sinner, those people who have a propensity to take literally those words tend to act on what they've heard.
Monica Davey, you heard the clip that we played from the O'Reilly Factor talking specifically about Dr. Tiller and referring to his practice as a death mill, I believe I'm quoting there. Does that change the context at which you approach this story in terms of what you're looking for, avenues of creating an atmosphere of violence, particularly against him?
It certainly doesn't change the way I approach the story. I think it's there's no question that this is a complicated story in a way to approach, and I have received hundreds of emails from the story. So certainly people are so divided over this issue. This is not a simple killing. People have really strong feelings about it. And, in fact, I've been interested to see how the anti-abortion groups have responded to this. They're in a complicated position. On the one hand, they did find Dr. Tiller to be someone who was performing abortions in the second and third trimester. They found him to be despicable and wrong. On the other hand, they have mostly condemned this killing.
Well, what are we to look for in distinguishing between condoning of an all-out war against people like Dr. Tiller and an active attempt on the part of abortion groups on both sides to distance themselves from this kind of violence? Monica, you first, and then Eleanor.
Well, I think that is the complicated thing, is to distinguish between those two. I mean, yeah, where is the line? I think that's the difficult question. And in fact, the suspect in this case, you know, as someone who some in the anti-abortion community, you know, they talked to him. They knew him. What's the difference between?
Eleanor Bader, at a moment when Barack Obama has suggested that with the nomination of Sotomayor as the nominee and the discussion not of abortion in her confirmation, but of something like affirmative action and other issues, identity politics, at a moment when there is a suspicion that at least at the national level, we're moving beyond the traditional debate over abortion, do you think Americans should believe we're more likely to be at war over this issue in the months and weeks ahead or less after what happened over the weekend?
You know, I've always hated the rhetoric of the abortion war, but when people start getting shot, and this is the seventh murder since the early 90s, it clearly has the hallmarks of war. So I think that the rhetoric is probably going to get ramped up on both sides, and I think that it's an issue. We can't shy away from the fact that it's a really important issue, and we really need to figure out a way to talk about how we can disagree with each other in civil ways and not resort to shooting people while they're in church.
Indeed. Monica Davey, New York Times reporter in Chicago, joined us by phone, and Eleanor Bader here in the studio, co-author of the book Targets of Hatred, Anti-Abortion Terrorism. Monica is a reporter for the New York Times. Thanks to you both. We go now to a big story you may have missed last week. Interest rates were spiking last week. Volatility in short-term and long-term interest rates and oil prices rising to about $68 a barrel today. To try to set this in context for us and to give you an indication of what you should be watching, Javier Blas, commodities correspondent for the Financial Times, joins us from London. Javier, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
It seems to me that if interest rates are spiking and that constrains mortgage rates, that hits demand in a very vulnerable place in the U.S. economy. Also, if oil prices rise, that hits demand and spurs inflation in another vulnerable place in the economy. Is that what we should be watching?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very worrisome, particularly the spike in oil prices in the last 10 days. It's almost $10 up. We are trading very close to $70 already. That means that U.S. drivers are heading for the road, for the driving season, the holiday season. We are going to start paying higher prices for the gasoline. That's really bad news for consumer confidence.
Looking at really macro demand questions, does this potentially push the global economy into more shrinkage, more of a recession? And that could put worries on in the financial sector?
I think that we are approaching levels where this is going to start getting worrisome, particularly in the U.S. Other places are a bit insulated because this increase in oil prices is coming mostly because of the weakness of the U.S. dollar. So at the end of the day, prices that we pay here in Europe remain to be stable because what we pay more on oil, we are gaining on the currency.
Now, the Chinese seem to be favoring short-term debt over long-term debt in what they're buying from the United States. Can Timothy Geithner change that around and affect oil prices in this meeting in Beijing?
I think that there is a lot of talk about what the Chinese are doing. We are not absolutely 100% sure if the Chinese have made that shift. But I think it's critical from this meeting with Geithner and the Chinese that Geithner try to hold the view on the dollar, that the dollar is not going to continue weakening. If he is not able to do that, we are probably going to see the dollar heading lower and probably to see at the same time higher commodity prices.
And more volatility. Thank you, Javier Blas from the Financial Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. The anticipation is becoming reality. General Motors has announced plans to idle plants in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and Orion, Michigan. One of those plants will be retooled to make a small car after it filed for bankruptcy this morning, which pulls it out of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. GM will be replaced by Cisco and Travelers in the Dow. You might say the world's largest auto company is going to move its headquarters from the Renaissance Center in Detroit to Washington, D.C. The government will own most of it after it officially files for bankruptcy. To take the pulse of what all this means, you could listen to Barack Obama, who speaks later this morning from the nation's capital. Or you could listen to GM Chief Fritz Henderson, who's in New York for the bankruptcy filing. Or you could just speak to Allison Harris at the Woodbridge Pub in Detroit.
It feels like it's been so slow churning and so expected that people aren't so much as apathetic as just not surprised. And I think that people are saddened, but I also think that they're almost relieved to have like an outcome.
Jerome Vaughn, news and program director at WDET Detroit Public Radio, joining us now live. Is Allison Harris right? Do we have an outcome, Jerome?
Yes, we do. Unfortunately, it looks like bankruptcy is the outcome, and we're just waiting to see how it's all going to pan out. I would add that I think people here in Detroit are not surprised, as she said, but I think they are stunned.
Well, let's talk about the transition. I mean, 2 years ago, if you'd talked about this scenario, people would have laughed at you and probably carted you off to Bellevue Hospital here in New York. A year ago, this was solidly unthinkable. When you were here co-hosting The Takeaway with me, this was the scenario that must be avoided at all cost. Now it's expected. What's it been like for your community to go through that rapid a transition? I mean, a 180 degrees doesn't even describe that kind of transition.
Oh, it's been really rough. I mean, people have, you know, the first time when we started talking about bankruptcy, you know, it wasn't understandable. I mean, as you were saying, largest automotive company in the world at one time, you know, a pillar of the U.S. economy going bankrupt. It was inconceivable. And what's happened is the groundwork has been laid over the past several months to make it a little more palatable, a little more acceptable, but it's been rough all the while. People are worried about, you know, their corner store because they know another 11 plants are going to be closed, another 3 plants are going to be idled. People who are retirees are worried about their pension and their health care. So it's been rough. The city of Detroit is working on a deal to set up tax breaks so the headquarters doesn't leave the Renaissance Center and go up the road to a suburb that's made an offer. So just all sorts of things like that, making life difficult.
Well, the cynicism you can hear in the voices of the workers. Here's Mike Huerta, who spoke with the BBC and has talked about how security long ago ceased to be a feature of employment at General Motors. He's been laid off 12 or 13 times. Listen to this, Jerome.
You get used to it, whether it's good or bad, you know, working in it, you get used to it. And certainly 12 years ago, I didn't have a wife and a daughter, but now I have a 2-year-old at home and I'm married. So the unemployment length of unemployment time is even more, you know, there's more on the table for me.
So, Jerome Vaughn, how are people thinking about the federal government managing General Motors, forcing it, for instance, to make high fuel efficient, smaller cars exclusively, if that turns out to be the scenario? Do people feel that that's a good thing, or will GM end up like Amtrak?
I think people are fairly neutral on it, to be honest. I mean, they see how bad the situation is right now, and they figure, you know, things really can't get that much worse. People in the Obama administration say, you know, we don't want day-to-day control of General Motors. We don't want to run a car company. I think most people take that at face value. They see that other companies that have gone bankrupt have come out of it. If you look at the airline industry, industry, Delta and Northwest, have come out of it. You know, they are now the world's largest airline. They're waiting for Chrysler to come out of bankruptcy. And so there is some hope that this will all work out.
Although Chrysler looks to me like a fire sale of assets, I wonder what's going to be there at the end of the day. And 3 months is the prediction for being in bankruptcy by the Obama administration. Does anybody buy that in Detroit, 3 months?
Well, no. I mean, you know, they're saying 60. Yeah, I mean, 60 to 90 days. Now, it might be a bit of sleight of hand. I mean, they're talking about splitting it into two companies, the new GM and the old GM, and the new GM will probably be able to get out of bankruptcy within a small amount of time, but the old GM, with all of these debts and other assets, will be in there for a long time, likely, and I think that's where you can get away with saying it's going to be 3 months. We'll see.
So is that the takeaway? Does the old GM become a kind of an insurance and retirement company with maybe a little banking on the side, and the new GM becomes like Some Cars and the Volt?
I think that's about right. And the, you know, I think the expectation is what really happens in the long run with the old GM. I mean, does it disappear entirely because of the large amount of debt that it has? There's likely to be a lot of legal wrangling over that part of the company.
But if that stock boosts, if the company does come out, then that stock actually comes off a dollar and rises to even $10, $20 a share, it'll be the hugest investment that anyone ever made, and they'll remember back to these times with fondness. Jerome Vaughn, thanks so much for helping us set it in context there in Detroit.
Anytime, John.
Our friend Jerome Vaughn, news and program director at WDET Detroit Public Radio, talking about the bankruptcy of General Motors. And Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much, John. 28 minutes past the hour. Just picking up where Jerome left off. So a person familiar with General Motors' plans in bankruptcy says that the automaker will permanently close 9 more plants and idle 3 others to trim production and labor costs under bankruptcy protection. So we have assembly plants in Pontiac, Michigan, Wilmington, Delaware. They will close this year, while plants in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and Orion, Michigan will shut down production but remain on standby. Now, we're getting this from an unofficial source because some of the workers have not been told that their plants are going to close, and that information comes from the Associated Press. President Obama's Supreme Court Justice nominee Sonia Sotomayor will begin meeting senators tomorrow. Some conservative Republicans have accused the appeals judge of racial bias because of her Hispanic heritage. Now, one of her comments getting a lot of heat from conservative Republicans was about a female Hispanic judge reaching a better conclusion than a white male. Republican Senator Arlen Specter was on Fox News on Sunday, and he said he didn't speak to her career history.
I believe that it's fair to ask her about the question, but she has a long, solid record to show that she's fair and not biased.
Sotomayor is the first Hispanic to be nominated to the Supreme Court. That's looking at news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everybody. Depending on your sport, it's an ugly or a beautiful morning this morning. That's right, a big weekend from track and field to basketball. Nadal is out of the French Open. We'll talk about that. But the big story, the third fastest 200 meters in history was run over the weekend by American sprinter Tyson Gay. Who got his secret? Who discovered his secret? Well, that, of course, was our Takeaway contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He just walked up to Tyson Gay and asked him.
I was pretty nervous before the race. And I know this may sound lame, but, you know, I call my mom, man. And she said, just relax, you know, even though it's your first race, you know, go out there and just be calm and patient, you know, and I took that into consideration.
Takeaway sports contributor and blogger Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen was on the scene at the Reebok Grand Prix track and field competition. He walked up to Tyson Gay and said, "I called my mom. That's my secret. Nice work."
It was a beautiful day. It was a perfect day for track and field. The Jamaicans were out in full effect. The crowd was amazing.
Why did Tyson Gay run, it seems to me, unopposed by Usain Bolt, who would have been the Jamaican who would be most likely to beat him?
Usain was not there, but the guy who actually was in the race that was probably one of the most high-profile people was Jeremy Warner, who we know is a 400-meter runner, right, and who was a celebrated 400-meter runner. And he was running the 200 that day as a training, as a warm-up for the U.S. trials and the World Championships in Berlin.
Well, this was a very fast heat. How, first of all, much does this preview what's likely to be the Olympics in a couple of years? And based on your judgment of this Reebok Grand Prix, where does track and field sit as a sustainable private sector, you know, pay-to-play sport like, say, world football, soccer, and some other global sports?
It definitely has its challenges, particularly with the doping problems that they've had in the past. I think they're trying to address that head-on, and they had, you know, Tyson after that, directly after, he was going to get tested. So I think they're trying to address that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of sponsorships and a lot of energy and a lot of interest. But like any specific industry, they need to find the niches that make it work. And in New York City, it makes sense to have a track meet. And have when you have Jamaicans versus Americans, you have the stands filled with Jamaicans and Caribbean folk. It was like a Caribbean Day parade in the stands.
So a great meet, a tentative step forward for the sport, and all in all, the headline is Tyson Gay.
Certainly, Tyson Gay. I also would say Tasha Danvers. I'll call her the People's Champ. She won the 400-meter hurdles. She's unsponsored, and she ran literally in like a white T-shirt and like some shorts.
Oh, that's great!
And it was a really exciting thing to hear her talk about that. She's like, "I'm looking for sponsorships, but no one's gotten her. She's an Olympic champion."
Oh, wow, that is great. Well, you called it on this program. The Orlando Magic rolled over the Cleveland Cavaliers 103-90 this weekend. That sets up the Magic and the Lakers in the finals. First of all, is this Magic team for real?
They're definitely they're the best team in the NBA right now in terms of teamwork. In terms of passing the ball, they dump it into Howard. Howard passes it out, and they pick apart teams with their three-point shooting.
Well, they shut down the timing of the Cavs, and they shut down LeBron enough of the games to win.
They had a guy named Pietrus who got his hand in LeBron's face. He was knocking down threes. He made LeBron tired, and I think he wore him out a little bit.
Well, you don't march into L.A., though, and shut the Lakers' timing down with Phil Jackson there on the sidelines.
Not at all. They have these longer athletic swingmen. It's Disneyland versus Disney World with Orlando and L.A.
That's right. That's right.
And the thing with L.A. is that they have the wisdom factor. They've been there before. They all know how to win, and they're going to be tough to beat.
Well, it's also Kobe. Kobe's got to step up. What do you think?
You mean the Black Mamba? Yeah.
Yeah.
Kobe is he's deadly. He's the closer in the NBA. Some people call him the best player in the NBA. If you look last year, the best defensive player from the Celtics played against the MVP from the Lakers. This year, that's exactly what happened with LeBron and Orlando. Now again, you have the best defensive player in Dwight Howard going against, some argue, one of the best players in NBA, Kobe Bryant.
Well, you don't have time to talk about Rafael Nadal out of the French Open in the fourth round, or the Detroit Red Wings and the Pittsburgh Penguins still going in the Stanley Cup. You want to call the NBA? Who's going to win, Lakers or Magic?
I'm going to call Lakers in seven.
Lakers in seven. Well, we'll hold you to it. We'll see Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen next week for sure, our takeaway contributor on all things sports. So on this question, we're asking you to contribute. It's a news story. Al Franken and Norm Coleman face off today in Minnesota's Supreme Court. Franken may finally become the state's junior senator. He's an entertainer. He calls himself a satirist. But what entertainer do you want to see in office?
I think Mr. Burns, the greedy oil tycoon from the Simpsons animated series, would make an excellent Treasury Secretary. He'd be like, "America, the TARP fund is running low, so we're going to begin eBaying poor children."
But he can't. Poor Mr. Burns is getting ready to campaign for mayor of Springfield. Here's his campaign manager.
98% of the voters rate you as despicable or worse. That's why we've assembled the finest campaign team money can buy. This is your speech writer, mm-hmm. your joke writer, mm-hmm. your spin doctor, uh-huh. your makeup man, and your personal trainer.
Entertainers can do it all. Meanwhile, Gretchen says Michael Scott should be another cabinet member.
Hi, this is Gretchen calling up in Boston, and I think an ideal person to become Secretary of Labor would be Michael Scott from The Office, played either by Steve Carell or Ricky Gervais. They would certainly make the workplace more fun in these troubling economic times.
All right, so we've got Mr. Burns as Treasury Secretary and Michael Scott, the boss from the office heading the Labor Department. What about the rest of the politicians?
I'd rather see politicians as entertainers, and I was thinking of Dick Cheney. I think he would be a riot on the comedy circuit.
I get it. Politicians are already entertainers. Well, thanks for that. From Ronald Reagan to Al Franken, what entertainer do you want to see holding political office? 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And some real headlines, some real news from our very own Femi Okeh right now. Femi?
Thank you very much indeed. The time just coming up to 23 minutes to the top of the hour. Brazilian and French authorities are searching for an Air France plane that went missing over the Atlantic hours ago. The Airbus 330 jet was carrying 228 people, including 12 crew members, 7 children and 1 baby. It left Rio de Janeiro for Paris yesterday. Air France officials say that the Airbus experienced wind turbulence and electrical problems before it lost contact. The Associated Press is reporting General Motors will permanently close 9 more plants and idle 3 others to shrink the automaker that's now under bankruptcy protection. A person familiar with the company's plan says that assembly plants in Pontiac, Michigan and Wilmington, Delaware will close this year. Plants in Spring Hill, Tennessee and Orion, Michigan will remain on standby.
It's Orion, Michigan.
Sorry, Orion, actually, Michigan. Thank you.
It's like Cairo.
You let me say that about... Two times.
I actually forgot. I forgot it was
you
Orion.
Forgot. And
I
then
forgot
you remember.
Someone from WDET, let us know.
I like the way that you remember in the middle of the news.
Sorry.
Thank you, WDET. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. One GM worker, Mike Huerta, who has been with the company for 12 years, said that this was not the first time they'd been laid off in the car industry, and he was kind of expecting it.
In the auto industry, you kind of prepare for this type of stuff when you're in it for any amount of time. There's a lot of fluctuations. This is probably the 12th or 13th time I've been laid off since I've been working there for 12 years.
So President Obama is expected to announce another $30 billion in federal aid to GM. A bankrupt judge will allow Chrysler to sell its assets to Italy's Fiat. The Italian company will take 20% control in Chrysler. And that's a look at some of the top stories making news today. How do you say it again?
Stories here in the United States.
No, Orion.
Orion, Michigan.
Thank you
Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A little linguistic exercise for you this morning. The Arabic word for traffic is zahme. And depending on where you speak Arabic in the world, there are different words for different ideas. And 20 years ago, you could say zahme meant traffic. Today, you could probably say fairly that the word zahme refers not just to any traffic, but the traffic in Cairo, Egypt, where there are at least 17 million people, and most of them vying for various places in the roads every single day. Barack Obama is going to be one of them come Thursday when he speaks in Cairo, Egypt, to the Muslim world. The question is, how does he get from place to place, and how will he, like everyone else in Cairo, deals with the zahma? Christian Fraser of the BBC knows precisely how bad things can get. He joins us from Cairo. Christian, good morning.
Good morning. You have me smiling. If he has to tackle the zahma when he comes here to Cairo, he's going to be in real problems. But we don't get many clues as to what is happening with this presidential trip, but there is one clue, and that is that the playing fields behind the Cairo University are being carefully tended, which we believe means or points towards the fact that he's probably going to fly into the university, perhaps on a helicopter, Marine One maybe, and land just behind the Cairo University complex. That's certainly the word on the street here.
So give us a sense of what it is about Cairo traffic that would argue rationally against any kind of a motorcade at all.
Well, I had my first experience of Cairo traffic 6 months ago when I landed here. I came from Rome, which is pretty good training in anybody's book to come to Egypt, and it does not compare in any way. The problem is that there's no lane discipline in Egypt. That's the first problem. So a three-way carriageway in the morning will suddenly turn into six, and you suddenly get this feeling of somebody swerving on the inside. I think the rear-view mirrors in a car in Egypt are really used to see the carnage and the accidents that you've left behind you. It certainly isn't used to see who's coming up on your inside. If you did that, you'd probably terrify yourself to death.
Well, but
But of course, there are traffic lights, right?
Yeah, but we don't pay any attention to traffic lights here. There are so many policemen in the streets of Cairo that they really are supplanted as the traffic light. If they've got their hand up, then you might stop. But really, the traffic lights are just incidental.
Rule of law, if the hand is up, you might stop.
You might stop. It depends whether he stood in the middle of the road as well. And really, I think there's a feeling in Cairo at the moment that something has to be done about it, because the traffic, particularly over the last few years, has got to the point where we have total gridlock in the morning. I come many different ways. It takes me, 45 minutes to come. What really, I guess, in New York would take about 10 or 15 minutes. It's that bad.
And people
and
the
smog.
People in New York, agonize about traffic. Quickly before we go, do you know the mileage from the airport to downtown Cairo, and then give us the timing of what a typical trip is?
It's about a half-hour trip in a car from the airport. If you were coming at the time that he's coming in the morning, you'd probably get stuck there for an hour. So I am probably expecting that if he is going to make any journeys in car, as happens with Hosni Mubarak when he moves around, the entire city comes to a standstill. All the traffic is stopped where it is. The police close the roads and the cavalcades come through on their own. The motorcades will get precedence over everybody else's commuter traffic.
Consider how overrated democracy is. It's great to have a dictatorship when you really want to make your way through traffic. Christian Fraser talking about Zahma traffic in Cairo. He's the BBC correspondent there. Thank you, Christian.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. This entertainer-politician thing actually goes back a long way. Ronald Reagan was an actor. Pat Paulson, a comedian, ran for president. What entertainer do you see in office?
I voted for Dick Gregory when he ran for president all those years ago. These days, I think perhaps Tommy Lee Jones. He's very well-educated, intelligent. I think he'd make a great president.
So she's speaking of political activist and comedian Dick Gregory, who actually ran for president in 1968 as a write-in candidate. He was serious. Stephen Colbert was maybe a little less serious. In honor of Al Franken versus Norm Coleman in the Minnesota Senate seat, we're talking about entertainers in the government. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Your suggestions? Femi OK has the headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, officials say that a plane missing somewhere over the Atlantic doesn't have enough fuel to still be in the air. Flight controllers lost contact hours ago with the Air France flight from Rio to Paris. 228 people were on board. The plane reported a short circuit as it flew through some strong turbulence. The airline says that it may have been struck by lightning, and the Airbus was due to land hours ago, so wouldn't have enough gas to be flying right now. France's transport minister is ruling out a hijacking, but says he fears the worst as to the Airbus plane's fate. We have some fresh economic news out this morning. Consumer spending went down a bit in April, but not as badly as predicted. Personal income went up in the same period, and the income number also beat analysts' expectations. The Dow Jones Index is kicking out Citigroup and GM. Only 30 companies make up the Dow. It's kind of the A-list of Wall Street. The insurance company Travelers and the tech company Cisco will take the place of the fallen firms. And finally, she was good, but not good enough. That's Susan Boyle singing her heart out in the finale of a British talent show this weekend. Susan Boyle won a worldwide acclaim when she was first seen on the talent competition. She actually ended up being the runners-up to the competition, and now she's in hospital suffering from exhaustion. Even the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has sent her a little message to make sure that she is okay.
Speaking of also-rans, yeah, that's another story entirely.
Thank you, they're both Scottish. Fancy that.
Fancy that. So a little more history lesson. For as long as the Renaissance,
Opera was an art form that tried to put it all together. And now, stay with me here. All of the senses in one artistic blowout event. That's what opera was all about. Whether low opera or high opera, you had the smells of the perfumed ladies or maybe the gaudily clad strumpets. There were the smells of the meats being roasted outside the opera house, the candles and the gas lights inside. This sensory explosion was extended by composers like Wagner, who intentionally tried to unite all art forms into a single, pure experience. Well, last night, as part of the Guggenheim Museum's Works and Progress series, there was another step in that direction. A scent opera. I'm serious, Femi. A scent opera called Green Aria. It was created by Stuart Matthew. The perfumes, the smells themselves, were composed by Christoph Laudamiel.
Right.
And the music was composed by the brilliant Nico Muhly and Valgeir Sigurdsson. Let me put you there.
Okay.
You're in a dark theater in the Guggenheim Museum.
I'm closing my eyes.
Here's the music. Chandler Burr, you were there last night, right?
Yes, I was.
What are you smelling right now?
It was actually pretty difficult to match the smells with the music, I have to say.
But basically, maybe you're recalling...
Christoph Laudamiel, who's a brilliant perfumer, made different shades of green, which I thought was very interesting. He's essentially showing off his mastery of technique, and he is truly a master of technique. And giving you sort of molding these into art form. These were not scents that you would wear. They truly were abstract. It's basically abstract expressionist paintings, except they're olfactory.
And there you are, Chandler Burr, New York Times scent critic, sitting there at the Guggenheim Theater, and you've got some sort of device that transmits something to your nose as you're listening to this concert?
Right. So you go downstairs into the theater, you sit down, and your seat simply has a tube, which is flexible, and you can adjust the nozzle right in front of you, a little bit away from you, and it's terrific. It's an absolutely amazing system, technically.
So technically, you were really excited by this. What was the range of smells, and how do you think that they created them?
Well, what they did was basically Stuart Matthew had this idea, and he went to the composers, Nico Muhly and Valgeir Sigurdsson, as you said, and to the perfumer, Christoph Laudamiel. And he said, look, I'm gonna do the libretto. I'm going to do a structure for this thing. And we want you to create these scents. And, of course, the composers created a music that went with it. And last night when they were talking, they gave a 15, 20-minute presentation. And they said it was basically like composing film music. There are certain beats that you have to hit. And Christoph composed the scents that were basically the actors in the opera.
So instead of a soundtrack, the music had a nose track. Here's from the second movement of, or this is a continuation from the scent opera last night at the Guggenheim. So about 125 people sitting in the Guggenheim with these tubes that you say,
right.
and we actually talked to a few of them to give their reactions of the kinds of things they were smelling. I want you to listen to their reactions, and then we'll talk.
It feels like somebody who just cut grass and then washed it, like out of the laundry grass. It was really nice.
It smelled sort of like a burnt tire or burning hair, but they had a little bit of that lime base that they had with all the greens in it. So you could tell it was a green color, but it was still filthy.
I feel like I just have the general green scent smell in my nose, and I'm actually really sick of it, and I kind of want to get away from it, but I feel like I bit into a sandwich, and I felt like I tasted the smell, and I was like, ugh.
The smells were very evocative there. You talked about green. They're deliberately trying to evoke green in the smell.
Yes, but what was interesting about it was that there were different greens, and that was what was fascinating with what Christoph Laudamiel, the perfumer, did. He took a concept of green and he morphed it into different aspects. There was a shimmering green that was sort of electrical. There was a funky green that was truly organic green matter sort of gone bad. There were all these mutations on green, and it's as if you had seen, I'll put it in visual terms, if you saw a green painting and you saw all different sorts of shades and uses of green, this is exactly what he did. It was quite daring.
Before I ask you whether it hung together or not, at moments of observing this, did the sense of smell enhance your sense of the music?
Did it create this visual quality that was attempted to be evoked by talking about particular colors?
The music in this case, I think, was more supposed to serve the scent. The scents were the actors in this. And it was these things were supposed to come in and come off like actors on a scene and basically sing, which is to say that you smelled them. He created things that were interesting. He created things that were shocking. He created things that were sort of fun and alarming, and he created things that were disgusting.
And they had names: Chaos, Magma, another green character, Absolute Zero,
Absolutely.
Industrial.
Yeah.
This was a sort of a first attempt. There have been other sorts of attempts, but this was a first one here. Did it hang together? Was there a story? Did you want to go, hey, I want you to smell this thing that I saw last night?
Yeah, I got to tell you, for me as a work of art, look, I think that technically it was extremely ambitious, and I think it was absolutely – it's thrilling as an idea that we can that artists can use, and I mean artists all the way to using this in a popular form. Look, I sat there and I thought of Quantum of Solace, the James Bond movie,
mm-hmm.
and I think that basically what you can do is you can do this. I would quote Stephen Sondheim here and a lot of other people, but Sondheim always says this: less is more. Now, this was overwhelming. It was all about the perfume. The perfumes were extremely strong, and they were literally right in your face. What if you took the Bond movie? He arrives in Haiti. What if you smell, just for an instant, you smell that ocean? He meets the Bond girl. You would smell her perfume. He's in Peru. Now, there are ambient scents all over the place. You could absolutely do that. This was not that, although it presages that.
But it demonstrated the technical possibilities of that. This was an ambitious sort of operatic version of it. Chandler Bird, New York Times scent critic, thanks so much for being our reporter adventurer on
Absolutely.
This trip. Again, the scent opera was at the Guggenheim last night, part of the Works and Progress series, Green Aria. You're listening to some of the music. Sorry we can't give you the smells. Fascinating to think about. Just like the Minnesota Senate race, Al Franken and Norm Coleman face off in the Supreme Court. What other entertainers could be in office besides Al Franken?
Comedian for president? Oh, I'd go with Mort Saul, the best political satirist I've ever heard.
Bugs Bunny would make an awesome politician. And an awesome leader, too. The drawback being, of course, that he's fictional.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We've had all kinds of entertainers, from Ronald Reagan to Pat Paulson to Stephen Colbert, either attempting to enter politics. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.